This is East End Inc. Tonight we present Tom Phelan reading from We Were Rich and We Didn't Know It, a memoir from my Irish boyhood. Mr. Phelan read his work at Canio's Books, Sag Harbor, in March of 2019.
I began writing We Were Rich and We Didn't Know It with the intention of trying to track down why I ever became a Catholic priest. But as I wrote, my father began to loom large, and I realized that I couldn't write a memoir without giving my father the space that his presence in my life demanded. And my father, John Joe Phelan, John Joseph, always called John Joe, was above all things a driven man who tried to eke a living out of a 52-acre farm that was low-lying, and when it rained, it held the water. So for several days after it rained, we couldn't work outside. So when we worked outside, it was almost in desperation. I had two sisters and two brothers, and from the time we were able to drag a galvanized bucket across the farmyard, we became part of the family enterprise, and the farm was a family enterprise. Everybody had their jobs to do. We could not loiter on our way home from school because we had to get home to do our work. My sisters and my mother mainly did the inside work in the house, but they also took care of rearing chickens and ducks and turkeys. And the turkeys, we might have 80 turkeys, and those were sold at Christmas, and it was on the money from the turkeys that we had a nice and decent Christmas. Meanwhile, the boys worked in the farmyard and also in the fields, and we drove horses from an early age, pulling harrows and grubs and rollers in the field. And we spent weeks every year on our knees thinning out drills of sugar beet, turnips, and mangels. And then in the fall, we helped with the saving of the hay, the turf on the bog, the root crops, and the cereal crops. And I am old enough to be able to say that when I was young, I wielded a scythe as part of the farm work. The first row around the field of cereal corn had to be cut down so that the passage of the binder that cut the corn could pass without doing any damage. This is called the forge. Dad told us children, if a big person ever asks you questions about the farm or about the cattle or the pigs or our family, just say, I don't know. It's not telling lies. It's a way of telling him to mind his own business. The place where we muttered the most I don't know answers was at Petey Flanagan's forge. Petey Flanagan was a big man with a hairy chest, unkempt hair, and giant hands that could squeeze water out of a stone. Besides shoeing horses, ponies, jennets, and donkeys, Petey also made iron gates and drill harrows. His forge, a galvanized shack attached to the end wall of Liffey's bike shop, was a most untidy place with bits and pieces of farm implements piled on the floor against the left-hand wall. Two of the shack's corners were so dark that monsters with metal teeth and eyes might have been crouching in them, and directly inside the open door was a space large enough to accommodate a horse. To the right side of this area stood the anvil bolted to a block of wood which was studded willy-nilly with old horseshoe nails hammered in during idle moments. Beyond the anvil was the fire and the bellows. The doorway was the only source of light, and it also served as chimney for the smoke of the anthracite. Everything in the forge was black, everything coated with a fine residue of burned coal. I loved being in the forge with its flying sparks, ringing hammers, wheezing bellows, and the foreign smell of anthracite. Being in the blacksmith's was to be among grown men who said, "F***ing this and f***ing that." Now I am going to read from the book. It's set in the country, and these are farming people talking to each other. A jennet, J-E-N-N-E-T, is an animal, a cross between a donkey and a pony. And the word egit, E-E-G-I-T, is an idiot. And someone says in the book, "You're a rail haze," which means Hayes is a surname, President Hayes. And rail is real. You're a real Hayes. When I was 11, our mare, Timahoe, needed new shoes, and Dad waited for a wet day to bring her to the forge. Eddie and I went along in the pony's cart, Eddie sitting backward, holding the reins of the mare trotting behind. Outside Petey Flanagan's, droopy-hatted farmers were already standing in the rainy street, each with a naked horse, waiting their turn to go into the forge. Dad paid Petey in advance, and left us with instructions about leading the mare home through the town when the job was done. Before he climbed back into the pony's cart, he whispered, "Them old lads will be asking you all kinds of questions, and you know what to say." We took our place at the end of the queue. No sooner was Dad out of sight than a red-faced man who hadn't shaved in a week asked, "How many horses does your father have?" My brother said, "I don't know." "Be Janie, you don't know a little thing like that." When an animal relieved itself inside a forge, Petey swept the effluvium out the door and across the path and built a dam with it in the gutter. In the puddle of rainwater and urine that formed behind the dung, he cooled red-hot newly forged shoes. Petey himself carried them out with tongs and dropped them in, where they hissed and steamed and spluttered and threw drops onto the legs of his trousers. The farmer ahead of us looked as if he had spent days standing out in the rain. The brim of his hat had collapsed, and it looked like an upside-down flower pot. "Are you the one that's going to be the priest?" he asked me. "I don't know." "Well, everyone says you are." A newly shod horse was led prancing out of the forge with his hoofs shining. The owner shortened his grip on the reins, and the horse whinnied loudly at the waiting mares. Petey stood in his doorway in his leather apron and coal. "I'd swear one of that lad's balls was left in when you cut him, Mick. There's too much spunk in him altogether." And out of the spills of rain, a waterlogged farmer led his waterlogged horse into the forge. A man behind us tied his animal to a telephone pole and went inside out of the rain. "One of us should go in too," Eddie said. "It's no use the two of us getting wet. We'll take turns." "We'll toss," I said. "I have a penny." Eddie won. He went into the forge and I stayed outside holding Timahoe's reins. "Hey, chappie, does your father still raise them little pigs?" a man called from the forge door. "I don't know." "Oh, f*** off, you little sleeveen, you know f***ing well." It was the first time anyone told me to f*** off, and I felt as if I had been severely scolded. A farmer behind me shouted, "Hey, young lad, you look like a rail haze, and you couldn't be one because none of them men ever got married. Is your mother a haze?" "I don't know." "You don't know your mother's own name? Are you an idiot or what?" I felt like a fool. I began to wonder whether Dad's order to stay close-mouthed was a wise one. Finally, it was time to lead Timahoe into the forge. Petey and his apprentice, Pierce, pushed her into the best position for the daylight to brighten their workspace. There was no electricity in the forge, of course. Before Petey grabbed Timahoe's fetlock, I asked him if I could pull the bellows. "Yes, but only when I tell you, and don't touch the fire or the iron in it." The bellows was a monstrous contraption operated by pulling a chain hanging from a pole attached to the top of the blower. The real joy of blowing the burning anthracite was seeing the iron turning red and then white, the exotic smell of the burning coal, and the heat from the fire on a chilly, wet day were wondrous. The beating of the rain on the galvanized roof added another layer of comfort. "Hey, Phelan," one of the waiting farmers said to my brother, "did your father sow sugar beet this year?" "I don't know." "He did," the blacksmith said, as he dropped Timahoe's hoof. Petey leaned against the mare's side. "He sowed 3 acres like myself, and I have the best beet I ever had. I want you, young fella," he pointed his pincers at me, "to tell your father I was drilling my beet on Monday, and my beet is so big the harrow got stuck between 2 of them and the horse was brought to a dead stop. What do you think of that, men?"
"Me jeez, Petey, you must have put great dung in the drills."
When Petey bent down to lift up Timahoo's hoof, the men all winked at each other. "Hey, Phelan, I heard your father's pony ran away in Marble last Sunday and crashed into the back of a motor car. Is that right?"
"I don't know." "I don't know, I don't know," the man sneered. "It'd be easier to get a fart out of a dead ass than to get an answer out of you."
The men chuckled. One of them said, "I asked your man on the bellows the name of his mother, and he said he didn't know." Petey threw one of Timahoe's old shoes into the pile in the dark corner. On his way to the mare's rear hoofs, he said, "She's a Hayes from up the road, his mother is, sister of Paulie's and Billy's and Jack's." I knew he was a Hayes the minute I looked at him, and turning to me, he said, "I hope you don't grow into an old bollocks like your grandfather." "He's going to be a priest," someone said. "No better job, a motor car and the best of grub and not having to work for it. Free house too, and golf all day, aye, and an owl one of a housekeeper to look after you. No temptation there, lads. Priest housekeepers always look like the back of a bus." Pierce, the apprentice, was wearing a sleeveless shirt, and his biceps were big, bulging, and blue-veined. He wore a leather apron, too, to protect against the sparks flying from the hammer-whacked, white-hot iron. He swung the big sledge and flattened the iron while Petey used a lighter hammer to shape it into a shoe on the points and edges of the anvil. Like the sound of a ticking clock, the two hammers rang out an even staccato until an up from Petey interrupted the flow, and the blacksmith held the long-handled punch while Petey whacked it in to make nail holes. "Hey, Phelan, you that's holding the horse's head," the man said. "Was your father in Port Fair with cows last Friday?"
"I don't know."
"What do you mean you don't know? Do you know anything at all? Do you even know what day it is?" Petey Flanagan was walking back to the anvil after dropping a horseshoe in the horse water outside the door. "I'll leave them lads alone," he said. "For all we know, John Joe told them not to be talking about things that they do be doing at home." "Is that right, Chappie? Did the father tell you that?" "Leave the chap alone," Petey said. "Sure, we all have things we don't tell anyone. Like, I never give away the price I get for an animal at the fair, and you'd never ask me, and I'd never ask you either. Them lads are not old enough to know what should and shouldn't be talked about, so they don't talk about anything." Petey bent over, with his back towards the horse's head. He grabbed the fetlock, lifted the leg, and put it between his knees. Our Timahoe was a quiet mare, and even so, my brother kept a tight grip on her bit. If any horse moved or tried to regain control of its legs while being shod, Petey shouted at the farmer for not holding the horse steady. "Do you want me to get f***ing killed or what?" It was also the farmer's fault if his horse nipped Petey. If that f*** was mine, he wouldn't bite a second time because he wouldn't have no f*** teeth to bite with. Sometimes when a horse's leg was still locked between his knees, Petey gave the animal a punishing elbow in the stomach and snarled, Hold up there, you whore. Do you have a name on your horse, Chappie? A farmer asked Eddie.
Yes, Timahoe, and she's a mare. Glory be to God on high, the lad knows something.
When the blacksmith and his helper finished making a shoe, Petey inserted the point of his punch into one of the nail holes to make a handle, and he pushed the red-hot iron against the mare's hoof. Then he threw the shoe in the urine pool and took the new piece of glowing iron out of the anthracite and shaped it on the anvil. When the iron for Timahoe's third shoe was pushed into the glowing anthracite, Eddie took my place at the bellows. Watching the blacksmith hammering the square-headed and sharp-pointed nails through the shoe holes and into the hoof, and then twisting the protruding ends off the nails between the claws of his hammer, was like seeing a circus clown perform a succession of tricks he has done 10,000 times. Silently, like a nurse assisting a surgeon, Pierce was always one step ahead of the blacksmith's needs. He passed a heavy rasp to Petey, who filed the nailed edges and the hoof smooth. He handed Petey a brush for painting the hoof with old engine oil out of a dented tin can. When he finished the job, Petey slapped Timahoe on the rump for being such a good client. Then he said, "Now, lads, there are 7 nails in a horseshoe. Would it be cheaper for your father to pay me 0.5 crown for each shoe with its 7 nails, or 1 penny for the first nail, 2 pennies for the second, 4 for the third, and so on up to 28th nail?" "The first way," Eddie and I replied in unison. "Begob, men," the blacksmith said, turning to the other customers, "these lads are not as thick as you think." Petey said, "Don't forget to tell your father about my drill harrow getting stuck between the 2 beats. And when we told Dad this, he said, "Either Petey is an idiot or his horse is worse than a bad ass."
This is East End Inc. We're listening to Tom Phelan reading from We Were Rich and We Didn't Know It, a memoir of my Irish boyhood.
The second reading I'm going to do is called The Jubilee Nurse. And in 1887, Queen Victoria celebrated her golden jubilee on the throne of England. And the women of England took up a collection to give it to her as a present. And the amount was £70,000, which at that time was a huge amount of money. And Victoria set the money aside for the training of nurses who would go into country places where there was no medical representation much in England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales. And our town got one of those nurses. And she was always called the Jubilee Nurse. Nurse Byrne was the sparrow that killed Cock Robin with her bow and arrow. Hiding in the elderberry bush near the harbour master's house on the canal line, her quiver slung across her back, she let fly and sank an arrow into the chest of the bully who thought he was the cock of the walk. Little grey and red feathers flew up in the air and floated across the canal like the tiny sails of tiny ships. And in my childish mind, Nurse Byrne and that bushwhacking sparrow were one. The robin was every bully. Bird-like in her shape, eyes and movements, Nurse Byrne was a tightly wound package of energy. Even at Mass on Sundays, she was never seen dressed in anything except the feathers of the Jubilee Nurse, navy blue stockings, dress, cardigan, overcoat and hat. Her gloves and shoes were black. Nurse Byrne concocted an ointment called Nurse Byrne's Cream, and Waddy Walsh in the pharmacy sold it in round cardboard tubs with her name on the lid. Whenever I heard about a fly in the ointment, I thought the fly was stuck in Nurse Byrne's tub of cream, sitting ever ready on the high mantelpiece in our kitchen. Dad rubbed the ointment on cows' dugs when they were sore. He used it too to take the squeak out of the wheels of the winter hay cart. When I got ringworm on my face, the ointment was rubbed on every day, and a special medal from the nuns was held against my face. Later, Mam told the nuns that the medal had worked the miracle. Nurse Byrne darted beak first into other people's misfortunes. "Open the door, mister, and if your wife has any marks on her, I'll get Long Tom down here in 2 shakes. Guard Thomas McGoldrick was called Long Tom to distinguish him from Guard Oliver McGoldrick, who was called Spuds. Dad said Spuds carried a bag of potatoes in the seat of his trousers. Nurse Byrne washed the dead with Lifebuoy soap and blocked their orifices with wads of cotton wool. She dressed the corpses in their shrouds and positioned them in their beds in preparation for their waking. Except in Protestant houses, she weaved a set of rosary beads through the cold fingers and clamped the dead hands together in an attitude of prayerful humility for eternity. And don't light a fire in the wake room. She spent a lot of her time on her bike, wobbling around deep potholes in mucky country lanes in Mount Mellick's environs. Much of her life was spent in kitchens rubbing ointment on children with various ailments. Sometimes she dosed a child, like Dad dosing a sick cow out of a long-necked bottle, the cow's head pulled up to one side and the eyes bulging, Dad's 2 fingers in the cow's nostrils to hold the head steady. And even though tears ran down the child's face as he tried to wiggle away, Nurse Byrne always won because of the fierceness of her eyes and the sharpness of her bird tongue and the strength of her tiny wings, and the medicine went into the mouth and down the throat without a drop spilled. Now, that wasn't too bad, was it, child? You'll be better before you can say Jack Robinson. For noisy chests and suppurating wounds and boils, she made poultices from a mixture of hot bran and goose grease. Goose grease was also rubbed into sprained ankles before they were tightly bound in bandages cut from white flour sacks. She used guilt and guile on farmers to give her dry bran and goose grease for poorer families. Out of her own pocket, she bought jars of sweet and gooey Mount Mellick malt and brought them to houses where the children were not thriving. Now, that's not for spreading on bread. It's for the children. 1 spoon each in the morning and before bed. She stood up to the big men, fluttering her wings while she pecked at them for abusing their wives and children with their porter drinking. "There's no bigger idiot than a drunk father. Hanging is too good for you, mister. Shame on you, shame on you." She had the same respect for the poor and not poor, and if a tongue-lashing was deserved, then it was fearlessly delivered. She shouted at Father Kelly in public for allowing his dog to run free and knock Mrs. Fitz off her bike and break her hip, reduced him by her form of address. "If you can't control your dog, Mr. Kelly, then don't keep a dog. You have no respect for other people." The nurse dressed the ulcerated legs of women who had borne too many children. She changed bandages for farmers who injured themselves with machinery. She cut fish hooks out of eyebrows and lips. She sewed up scrotums that had been ripped on the barbs of barbed wire. "Ah, nurse, sure I'm too shy to show you me bag." "Mister," she'd reply with hands on her hips, "you don't have a bag, you have a scrotum. And I see scrotums hanging out of dogs and bulls and asses and horses every day. There's nothing special about yours. Take off your trousers and stop thinking your scrotum is any better than a stray dog's." She dressed wounds caused by flesh-ripping saws, finger-squashing hammers, bone-piercing chisels, and threw the foot crowbars, and stepped on rusty nails which required the administration of an injection. "Be a man, for God's sake, it's only a needle. Try giving birth to a babby sometime and you'll know what pain is." She repaired those who had been kicked by horses and gored by horns, or who had done a bad job of trying to kill themselves. "If you don't come to see me before you try this again, I won't lay you out for your wake. And you lie there in the bed all crooked with your eyes bulging out and your tongue hanging out and your water leaking out of you and stinking. And won't that be a grand sight for your mother and father?" Like Dad pulling calves out of cows, Nurse Dunn pulled 3 generations of babies out of their mothers in Mount Melick and its surrounding townslands. To some houses she brought her own towels and only demanded hot water. When she delivered me and slapped my bottom, I cried loud, so loudly that she muttered, "This lad has a voice that would fill a church." Those were the first words spoken about me ex utero. Because it was the Jubilee nurse who uttered them, the oracle at Delphi had spoken. I imprinted on the church like a chicken imprinting on a duck that it has accidentally hatched out. The course of my life was set before the slime and blood of birth had been cleaned off me. The nurse's words became so firmly attached to me that 4 years later, on my first day in school, I was told by three nuns that I would make a lovely priest. Pious believers had taken the midwife's words and run before me, preparing my way and making straight the highway to the priesthood. As she grew older, Nurse Burns' hearing began to fail. "Will you stop whispering, for God's sake? What's the matter with you?" So she spoke louder and repeated herself more often. And whenever she passed me on her bike into town, she screeched, "When you were born, you had the loudest cry I ever heard, Tom Phelan, and the biggest B.O.T. Tom, too." And she rode away, leaving me at the mercy of the lads who had heard her, and they called out, "Big arse, Phelan, big arse, Phelan." Near the end of her days, Nurse Byrne bought a car and became the terror of the town's children and dogs. She had grown so small that she only saw a slice of the world between the dashboard and the rim of the steering wheel. When she died, it was as if a mountain had been moved off the horizon during the night. The cock robins of the town once again swaggered in the domain that had been hers for 40-odd years, and most of the babies she had pulled out were at her funeral. It wasn't until her headstone was put up that the town discovered Nurse Byrne's name was Catherine. That's it. Thank you.
This is East End Inc. We heard Tom Phelan reading from We Were Rich and We Didn't Know It, a memoir of my Irish boyhood, published in 2019 by Simon & Schuster. Tom Phelan was recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor in March of 2019. His novels include The Canal Bridge, published in 2014 by Skyhorse, and other titles include In the Season of the Daisies, Iscariot, Derry Cloney, and Naylor. Canio's Cultural Cafe at 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor presents the following free literary events. On Saturday, November 2nd, a literary costume party in celebration of 20 years ownership of Canio's by Marianne and Catherine. Details are at canios.com. Search for events. On Saturday, November the 9th at 5 p.m., Camelia Calhoun presents her memoir, The White Moth, Three Generations at a Tuscan Villa. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth and occasional fifth Wednesday each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Zocher.